Check session number 27344, wheel 27.
Roman Candlelight, wheel 27.
The magnetic loop round the flight deck was, generally speaking, quite effective. And the microphone was arranged so that, I don't know if you've seen them, they record sound from the outside as well as from the inside. So that if there is a wind blowing past, the wind noise is the same on both sides and your voice comes over it. Works quite well. And I used to get to speak to the captain of the flight deck or the petty officers in charge very clearly, and we had a really good rapport in the flight deck, and we could get things moving and get them changed and all the rest of it. But all the time, it is dangerous on the flight deck, and when the engines are running, it's very dangerous, and people have got to be aware of it. There have been men blown over the side with a jet blast. And in my own ship, we had a man who came up on the flight deck in a light boiler suit and sandals, because we were in the tropics, and this was what he was wearing down below. And he came up onto the flight deck not knowing what was going on. He was a seaman or something like that. And on the flight deck, there was an aircraft moving, and he was turning. And to turn a jet, you put the brake on one wheel and open the throttle. And the thrust takes you round the one wheel which is stopped. But in order to get round, you really got to have quite a lot of throttle. So there's a lot of blast coming out the back. And the pilot driving this aircraft round was being directed by somebody, showing him where to go. And this man who had come up and just stepped out of the island was caught in the jet blast and blasted against the side of the island and was held there until the aircraft finished turning. And he was very badly burned. So this gives you an idea of how dangerous it can be when you don't know what's going on. But again, to give you an idea about this, if you imagine you've got a number of aircraft up in the area up forward off the actual flying deck, but it's fairly full. So aircraft which are still landing on have got to be maneuvered very carefully to get them off the flying deck, ready for the next one coming on. And I had a situation on one occasion where I had a Vixen parked more or less underneath the Flyco on the island, and I had a Scimitar landing on, and I wanted him to taxi aft of the Vixen and go into one side again. Now, when you imagine a ship is going into wind, there's about 30 knots of wind over the deck. And when the aircraft is going to turn, he's turning on a braked wheel and he's opening his throttle to go round. As he goes round, when he comes broadside onto the wind is blowing against his fin surface, the tail, trying to blow it back in the other direction. So he's got to open his throttle even more. And going round across the deck, he's at quite a high throttle setting. And as he gets round past the centre of the turn, the wind effect drops. And there he is with full throttle on, you know, a lot of throttle. And jet engines are slow to react to throttle settings. So he throttles back, but the engine doesn't immediately lose power. It still has quite a lot of power on. So the rate of turn speeds up. And it can take him by surprise. And I had an occasion where the Scimitar coming off, exactly this happened. And his wingtip struck the tail of the Vixen, which was standing parked, simply because the rate of turn took him by surprise. It happens to everybody. You know it's coming, but you don't know when. And he let him, and it wasn't his wingtip, it was his tail tip that went just too far and struck the tail of the Vixen. So after that particular land on and flying had finished, the captain decided he was going to have an investigation into why these two aircraft were damaged. It's quite a usual thing to do. The captain would investigate it. So captain had his table, as they call it, where he stands and listens to what is said about the particular misdemeanour. And in this case, it was the captain of the flight deck, my captain of the flight deck, who was on a charge for misdirecting the Scimitar. And the Scimitar pilot, who was possibly also on a charge for not having controlled his aircraft properly. So anyway, they started off and the damage was described and circumstances were generally described. And as part of the circumstances, he asked me, at least I was asked, to speak to the captain and explain what happened. So I said, well, this accident is my fault, because the captain of the flight deck said to me, shall I move that Vixen? And I said, no, leave it where it is. And then I explained to the captain this business of the aircraft turning and how the pilot knows that this effect is going to occur, but he doesn't know when, and he can be taken slightly by surprise. And this is what happened for the Scimitar pilot. And I said, the captain of the flight deck was directing the aircraft absolutely correctly, and it's nothing to do with him. So the captain said, yes, I was watching, I thought that. So I got a minor reprimand, and the captain of the flight deck walked away from it. Afterwards he came up to me and says, I didn't expect that. No, we did get on well together. But the whole business on the flight deck was always, always dangerous, and everyone had to be taught right from the beginning. And this is why discipline is so important in the services, because it's got to become self-discipline. And right from the start, you can persuade people to have discipline, you can tell them to have discipline, you can force them to have discipline by punishing them if they don't, but in the end they've got to learn self-discipline. And it does work. And we had a great flight deck party, and that sort of incident I've just described between the Vixen and the Scimitar was, I think, one of the few accidents we had on the flight deck. We had three other accidents that I knew of. One of them was a Gannet which was coming into land. All the other aircraft were on deck and we were just waiting for the Gannet. And I don't know what happened to the pilot of the Gannet. But he came round to land on, and as he went downwind, right to turn, he had his undercarriage down, and as he came round turning in onto finals, he pulled his undercarriage up. And he was coming in to land with his undercarriage up, so he was sent round again. Now, on the flight deck landing mirror, there are two big red lights either side, and you put those on to say, go round again, don't land. So these had been flashed on, and off he went round again, and he went downwind with his wheels down, came round to land on, and pulled his wheels up again. I can't think what happened to the man, but he did this three times. And the third time, they called him on the radio and told him what he was doing. And as he got round to come in to land on the flight deck, he stalled on the approach and spun in and crashed. And all three were killed. Another accident we had was the very, very earliest catapult takeoff of a Buccaneer. The Buccaneer came in and landed on, and we in the flight deck, of course, were interested enough to have a good look round. We had to move it and all the rest of it. And we got him in position on the catapult for takeoff, and he was shot off, and I don't know what happened. Engine failure, whatever. But he crashed ahead of the ship and was killed. So we don't know what happened to him. And the third serious accident was, we were in the channel, flying up, we were steaming up and down the channel. And we'd been practicing quite a lot, and they had decided that the aircraft from HMS Hermes were going to take part in the Paris Air Show. And we required to put up a maximum effort. That was 8 scimitars and 8 vixens, or whatever the numbers were, something like that. So the flight deck was absolutely jam-packed with aircraft, ready to take off. And we started off with the scimitars. And as they went off, as I said to you, every time a scimitar was launched, it spewed fuel and it blew back over the flight deck. Now, I was standing at the point where I launched the aircraft. I was the man waving the wee flag, telling the pilot when he was ready and the flight deck engineer officers when they were ready that now was the time to go, and everyone went off together. So I was flagging them off. And my gear was a full flight deck kit with boots, socks and all the rest of it, and a helmet and goggles. So I was wearing the full flight deck kit as I started to send them off. And after 2 or 3 scimitars had gone off, the amount of fuel they'd been spewing had smeared my goggles. And although I was trying to wipe them with my gloves, it wouldn't clear, and I was still seeing smeared. So I pushed my goggles up out of the way so I could see clearly what was going on. And the last of the scimitars went off and all was well. And then we're going off in pairs, 2 catapults. And when they're on the catapults, the wingtips are not very far apart, you know, a couple of feet apart. And you're standing there between 2 aircraft going at nearly full throttle. You don't hear noise, you feel it. It is absolutely astonishing, the noise you get there, even with ear defenders. And we all had ear defenders, as myself, the flight deck engineer officer, one of the flight deck engineering ratings, and a man who was going to be commander air of one of the new ships, and he just had come on board Hermes for experience and he wanted flight deck experience. So he came down with me to see what I did and what it was like, just to get a feel for it. So he was standing beside me, getting the feel of these powerful engines going within, less than 20 feet of your lug hold. Anyway, the first Vixen was on the port catapult, and I was watching him, and he was getting strapped on, ready to be launched. Now, when he's launched, there's a tricycle undercarriage, and he taxied into position and was square on the catapult, and the jet blast deflector came up behind him. It's a huge metal sheet which protected the rest of the flight deck from his jet when he was going at full throttle. Jet blast deflector came up. The shuttle from the steam catapult moved back under the aircraft, and the 2 flight deck engineer ratings went over to hook on the shuttle to the aircraft. Now that's done with a thick wire strop, which is quite heavy, and it takes the 2 ratings to lift it and put it in position. So it's hooked on, and when it's hooked on, the flight deck engineer officer edges the shuttle forward until the strop is taut. And then the 2 flight deck ratings run away, one comes to me and the other goes down over the deck edge. Now the aircraft is ready to launch. So I'm watching the flight deck engineer rating, who's got the catapult organised, and he has an indicator to give me that he's ready. And I'm looking at the pilot to watch him, and I start to wind him up to full throttle with a green flag. I have a red flag in my left hand in case I want to stop them all. So I'm winding up with the green flag, and when he's at full throttle and checked all his instruments, he looks at me, gives me thumbs up, and puts his head back onto the headrest, ready to be launched. So then I drop the green flag, and the shuttle starts to move forward. Now, he's going to move 20 tons from 0 to over 100 knots in 50 feet. So it's an enormous pull. The strop to the shuttle from the aircraft is at an angle of about 30 degrees. So if you think of the triangle of forces, there's a forward force and there's a vertical force. The vertical force, in fact, increases the weight of the aircraft quite substantially at that instant in time. And you can see the whole aircraft settle down on the oleos with this increase in weight. That's the first move. Before it starts to move forward, it settles. And at that instant in time, the starboard tower burst. So the aircraft started to move forward with a burst tire, making sparks, of course. The burst tire shattered and punctured the starboard drop tank. So the fuel was spewing out of the starboard drop tank, and the whole thing went up in a ball of flame. Boom! And there we were on the forward end, all in a ball of fire. And the aircraft went off, and the Vixen behind, the one that had just been shot off with the flaming drop tank, called up and said, "Your starboard drop tank is on fire, jettison your drop tanks." So he jettisoned his drop tanks, and he flew back to Hull Far. And they discovered that the underside of his wing and the whole of the starboard boom and tail had lost the skin just in those few seconds of the ball of fire. Now, the four or five of us standing at the starboard wing were right in the middle of this ball, and I could feel my gear, my flight deck overalls were on fire. So I lay on the deck and tried to roll to get rid of the flames which were on my back. I don't know what the others were doing. I don't know where they went or what they did. But anyway, within seconds, my flight deck ratings were up and beating off the flames. So I was wheeled off down below to the sick bay. And then I found that one of the others, the flight deck engineer officer and the flight deck rating, were both all right, because their, flight deck gear and goggles and everything else had been in position and they were all okay. But because I had moved my goggles up, the top part of my face had been burned and my beard had been singed well and truly. And the smell of burnt hair under my nose is absolutely bloody appalling. Anyway, I went down to sick bay, and this other man who'd been on the flight deck having experience was there as well. I said, "Oh, I'm sorry to see you here. What happened to you?" And he said, "I was wearing nylon socks and they've melted onto my ankles." So he was injured, but not seriously. But it taught him a lesson that on his ship, he would make sure everyone was going to be correctly dressed on the flight deck.
Can you just explain the gear as well that you would wear on the flight deck?
Oh, well, it was trousers and blouse, and you could have a helmet which would come up, a hood that would come up in bad weather. But it was normally a helmet. The flight deck helmet was a canvas helmet, and there were a number of different colours on the flight deck. The flight deck officer was white. The aircraft handlers were yellow. The mechanics were blue. The engineers were white with a black stripe, that sort of thing. So you could look down the flight deck and know who you were looking at. But we had flight deck boots, which were suede, lovely boots. And we were always taught to wear woolen socks, standard kit. And the material of the flight deck trousers and blouse, which were waterproof, were also fireproofed, and were very effective. But just the fact that I'd moved my goggles out of the way meant my face had been burned. It wasn't all that serious, but I did have scab all over it for quite a while. And my beard, the doctor said, "We'll leave your beard, and when your beard grows a bit more, you'll be able to shave it off." So I had it there for about 2 weeks. But anyway, as I say, we were going up and down the channel practicing for the Paris Air Show. So after they got rid of the Venom that was on fire and they got rid of me from the flight deck, the assistant flight deck officer came up and carried on launching the others. So the Scimitars and Vixens were all airborne and they went off to do what they were going to do over the Paris Air Show. And we had on board at the same time a number of VIPs. And these were people who came from all sorts of different places, including senior officers of the other services. And we, we did in fact have the Lord Mayor of London on board that day to watch operations. So when they were away at the Paris Air Show, they were watching operations on the flight deck, how we would deal with various emergencies. And one of them was erecting the emergency barrier. So at the end of the whole exercise, the assistant flight deck officer came down to see me. And I said, how did you get on? He said, we did it in 2 minutes, 50 seconds. Ah, dear, oh dear. But there you are. Obviously the training was good.
Did it ever have to be used, that barrier?
No. Don't think so. Well, not in my time in Hermes, it wasn't used. I don't know what happened after that. Of course, latterly, by the time it came up to the Falklands, 1980, it had been sold to the Indian Navy. And it was only by a stroke of very good luck that it hadn't gone, that they were able to take it back and modify it in time to go down to the Falklands. God, the way the politicians treat the services is absolutely appalling in every way. They ask the service to do things without giving them the right equipment and without giving the time or the money to train with it. And it's not surprising that things go wrong. But, I mean, in the battlefield when you get things going wrong, it's because they haven't had time to train on that particular equipment. It really is terrible. But anyway, I was then sent ashore from Hermes, and that was my last real connection with a flying job.
I was just going to ask, because obviously while you were on Hermes, there was a film made as well, wasn't there?
Yes. A film called Know Your Navy. And I featured in that quite a bit. And I've been trying, or thinking about trying for some time to get a copy. But I approached Admiral Ligo and I said, do you remember that film? And he said, oh yes, that was the film we used to show when I was in charge of the recruiting team going around the country. And he was one of the early senior officers of that. He used to go to all the universities, and this was one of the films that they showed about the Fleet Air Arm. I said, well, I'd like to get a copy of that, even if it's just an old copy that I can transfer to a video. And he said, oh, I don't know. But I don't think he tried.
And what was it about, really? Was it meant as a recruiting film, or was it just to show the operations of the
company? Oh, no, I think it was meant as a recruiting film. I think that was its purpose, why they, who paid for it. But they did a very good job in going around the ship and showing all parts of the ship and demonstrating, I thought, quite clearly why all parts of the ship had to work together as a unit. I mean, there was no point in having the seamen as a separate unit entirely. And in one of the ships I was in, it caused quite a lot of dissent when there would be a broadcast in the middle of the day, hands to making men clothes. Now, this is the seamen having a half day, and the airmen were going to be slaving away all the time on the flight deck. Absolutely ridiculous. So the Commander Air stopped that very quickly. He said, you can have your bloody making men, but don't tell everybody about it.
So what happened when you'd left Hermes? Where did you go to then?
My family was living in Leon Solent at the time, and I went ashore from the ship with my face burned, and I was trying to wear my cap, but my face and head were so swollen and my cap was sitting on my head like a pea on a hill. It really did look absolutely terrible. So I had my cap off most of the time, and of course going home in the bus, the number of people that gave me a very peculiar look. Anyway, I got back home and my son was playing outside and he looked up and saw me and, you know, I just wasn't normal and he just said, hello, Dad, and carried on playing. And when my wife saw me, she was in tears, poor girl. But it was just a matter of waiting until everything went down and I was able to shave off my beard. But I did, in fact, have a bit of pneumonia because I'd obviously sucked in a bit of phlegm into my lungs. But luckily, it wasn't too much. So I was there, and then I was sent to RAF West Raynham, to the Central Fighter Establishment as Naval Liaison Officer. And quite honestly, that was a total waste of time. It really was. And I said so to my bosses in the Admiralty. One way or another, it got back to the Air Commodore at West Raynham that I'd said that my job was a waste of time, and he wasn't the least bit pleased. But it was. Because at that time, Fighter Command had become only the Lightnings. I mean, that was the only fighter that they had. And they were, what I found absolutely incredible was that Fighter Command thought up the threat that they were going to be able to answer. So naturally, they thought up one that they could answer. The real threat was probably something entirely different. And by this time, we were having guided missile sites, forgotten what they called the guided missile, anti-aircraft guided missiles. Can't remember. All up and down the East Coast. And this was much more of a guard against stuff coming from the East than ever the Lightnings were. And the thing that they were trying to find out how to deal with in the Lightnings was the very high-level flying Russian aircraft coming over doing photography. Now, they used to come over at something like 60,000 feet. So the Lightning pilots were trying to devise some tactic that could be used to get a Lightning up to 60,000 feet and chase these buggers away. And it was very interesting. It really was very interesting. What they would do was fly along at 35,000-40,000 feet, full throttle, until they got up to maximum speed. And then they would pull back hard, leaving it at full throttle, and use the momentum to get up. And they could just about stagger up to 60,000 feet before they started to fall away again. So if they misjudged it, they didn't get anywhere near this bear or whatever it was called. And I find it absolutely incredible that the Air Commodore in charge of the Central Fighter Establishment spent most of his time fighting an internal political battle to justify the existence of Fighter Command when it was unjustifiable. And some officers further down the line, wing commanders and one group captain that I got on with, I said to them, what you really ought to be trying to do is to develop something like the American Tactical Air Force, because the next World War, the first indication as far as we're concerned in the Fleet Air Arm is when the carriers are all sunk, because the Russians know where they are better than we do. And I said, as far as you're concerned, you haven't got a real answer to a threat except these guided missiles. And the only sort of war that we're going to be able to fight in the future is a limited war of some kind, where we can get the forces there, use whatever aircraft carriers we've got to fight the way ashore or help fight the way ashore, get the troops in from the ships like the Fearless, which is a combined services landing ship, and whatever other ships have got to get the troops ashore, because any of these wars have got to be won by feet on the ground. They're not going to be won by people in the air. We can only help. And they were tutting and tutting. And in 1962, one of the jobs I was given at Central Fighter Establishment was to keep an eye on what was happening on vertical and short takeoff and landing aircraft. And air-to-ground attack weapons. So I used to go around anyone who was anything to do with this sort of business. And the place which interested me most was Dunsfold, where they had the flying bedstead and the start of the vertical takeoff aircraft, which at that time was numbered 1027.